Do you ever struggle with the question, if God is good, why is there suffering? We unpack this timeless question in a free chapter download from Why You Can Believe. It's called Why Does God Allow Suffering? And it's honest, hopeful, and deeply personal. From free will to a broken world, to the way suffering can lead us to God, this chapter will equip you with real biblical insight. Get your free download today at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources.
You're unbelievable. Hello and welcome along to this podcast special of Unbelievable, the programme that brings Christians and non-Christians together for dialogue and debate. It's a podcast special because there is no broadcast programme on Premier Christian Radio of Unbelievable this week, making way for our special fundraising appeal for Premier Lifeline. It's an essential service for people who are struggling in one way or another, need help, prayer, advice. And that's something that we offer across the whole of the UK and beyond. If you want to support that, you can donate to the appeal at premier.org.uk/donate. Now, whenever Unbelievable isn't broadcasting in its usual Saturday slot, I usually take the opportunity to put something a bit lengthier out on the podcast, something we wouldn't be able to squeeze into the normal hour and a half that the programme normally occupies. And so I've been holding on to a debate that took place between William Lane Craig and Daniel Kame in the Ireland tour that Bill was on with John Lennox earlier this year. So we're going to be hearing the audio of that today. It is a long one, so this is for the real debate junkies out there who want to hear the full-on Does God Exist debate that they had in Ireland earlier this year. Just a few mentions, though, of things I'd like you to know about before we launch into that debate. Unbelievable, the book is, of course, available wherever you are in the world. You can now order the story of the show and why, after 10 years of talking with atheists, I'm still a Christian. It's my case for faith at unbelievablebook.co.uk. If you are listening to this in time, tomorrow on Radio 2, that's Sunday morning, the 2nd of July, on BBC Radio 2, broadcasting to the whole nation. I'll be sitting down with broadcaster Claire Balding on her Good Morning Sunday show from 7:30 in the morning, talking about the book. So if you're able to tune in to BBC Radio 2, I'll let you just this once choose a different radio station to Premier Christian Radio. You will be able to hear me from 7:30 in the morning. That's Sunday, the 2nd of July, talking about the book. Of course, we've got a launch event coming up for the book as well in Woking in Surrey. That's on Tuesday, the 11th of July at 7:45 in the evening. There's going to be music as well from singer-songwriter Ben Trigg. I'll be there, obviously, talking about the story of the show and my case for faith and signing books as well. Free event, so do come along if you possibly can. It's at Woking United Reformed Church in Woking, Surrey, Tuesday, the 11th of July. And there are details at the book website as well. That's unbelievablebook.co.uk. Had some lovely reviews coming in on Amazon.com as well and Amazon.co.uk. The very first one was one I actually posted on the website as well, from a Mr. Lynx. I think he's probably an agnostic by the looks of this, but the very first review was a 5-star saying, interesting, thoughtful and well-written. Although clearly and unashamedly written from a position of faith, this interesting, thoughtful and well-written book, deriving from the author's conversational radio programme between Christians and non-Christians, offers spiritual, intellectual and moral challenges, not only to believers in Christian doctrine, but those apart from it, either as atheists, agnostics or members of other faiths. The book complicates and exposes much of the ignorance and unfamiliarity of the new atheists, though might benefit from a deeper consideration of their self-positioning. It shows the wider options for belief possible through self-interrogation and demonstrates the continuing and vital role religion can and does play in our culture. So thanks to whoever that was that left that one. But you're welcome, of course, if you're reading the book, to both let me know what you think about it. I'd love to hear from you. unbelievable@premier.org.uk. And of course, to leave a review at the Amazon website as well. And do tell others about the book, unbelievablebook.co.uk, for more info. And of course, the details about the launch event and indeed the competition we launched last week, where you can win one of 5 signed copies if you get in there in time. Another couple of things I just want to tell you about before we get into the debate today. London Bible Week is coming from the 17th to the 22nd of July at the Emmanuel Centre in central London. It's going to be really exciting. Lots of great speakers there. LondonBibleWeek.com. I'm actually going to be hosting the two talks by Tom Wright on Friday, the 21st of July. So if you can get along to the 4:30 talk or the 7 p.m. talk, then I'd love to meet you there as well, as I'll be hosting those. So if you can get along, more details at LondonBibleWeek.com. And of course, there's a full conference day on the Saturday, the 22nd of July. If you can make it, look forward to seeing you there, LondonBibleWeek.com. And finally, I'd like to give these guys a mention whenever I can, the Unbelievable Christian Skeptic Discussion Group, very much an informal discussion group, something that came out of the show, not of my own creation, but just unbelievable listeners, both Christians and skeptics, who wanted to get together on a regular basis to talk about issues. They're having their next meeting on Monday, the 10th of July. That's at their usual venue, the Summers Town Coffee House near King's Cross in London. So what's going to be happening? Well, we've got a night on intelligent design. Well-known ID advocate Jonathan McClatchy is going to be speaking there with his friend Bruce Blackshaw, who studied the philosophy of intelligent design for his thesis. So we'll get both the science and the philosophy of intelligent design. Again, that's Monday the 10th of July from 7:30 at Summers Town Coffee House near King's Cross in London. More details at the Unbelievable Christian and Skeptic Discussion Group at the meetup.com website. And of course, there's lots of discussion that happens afterwards between both the Christians and skeptics there about what's being presented. So if you can get along, do so. Right, that's about all for now in terms of events and things coming up that I wanted to let you know about. Be back to the normal format of the show next week, and we'll be bringing you the long-awaited Grill Paul Copan episode of the show, in which the Christian philosopher sits down with me and takes a variety of questions that you sent in. So listen out for that at the same time next week. Don't forget, you can find all of your unbelievable needs met at the Unbelievable website, where you can also find links to features, interviews, videos, resources, and of course this year's Unbelievable conference on DVD and MP3, CD and digital download. PremierChristianRadio.com/unbelievable. Right now, time to get into the debate that we're airing on the podcast. Back in March, William Lane Craig travelled the island of Ireland on a speaking tour that included various debates, lectures and meetings. Well, on March the 23rd, he debated atheist philosopher Daniel Kame. They presented their arguments at the Edmund Burke Theatre, Trinity College Dublin, on the topic, Does God Exist? And the debate was followed by a question and answer time. Well, you're going to be hearing both of those on the podcast today. Special thanks to the Christian Unions Ireland for their efforts in organising the tour, and to Trinity College Dublin for hosting this particular event. William Lane Craig begins in today's debate.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, thank you very much, and good evening. Let me begin by thanking the Christian Union for inviting me to participate in tonight's debate. It's been years since Jan and I were last in Ireland, and we were very delighted to receive the invitation. And it's also good to see Daniel Kame again tonight. Dr. Kame and I have interacted intellectually on this question previously, and I look forward to another stimulating and cordial exchange. Now, in tonight's debate, I'm going to be defending two basic contentions. First, that there are good arguments to think that theism is true, and second, that there are not comparably good arguments to think that atheism is true. Now, I'll leave it up to Dr. Kame to present his arguments for atheism before I respond. In this opening speech, I want to sketch five reasons in favor of God's existence. As a professional philosopher, I think that God makes sense of a wide range of the data of human experience, including philosophical, scientific, ethical, historical, and existential considerations. What are some of these data? Well, number one, the origin of the universe. Have you ever asked yourself where the universe came from? Typically, atheists have said that the universe is just eternal and uncaused. But there are powerful philosophical arguments, as well as strong scientific evidence, that the universe is not eternal in the past, but had an absolute beginning a finite time ago. Philosophically, the idea of an infinite past is very problematic. Just think about it for a minute. If the universe never had a beginning, then the number of past events in the history of the universe is infinite. But how could an infinite number of past events elapse one after another in order for today to arrive? That would be like trying to count down all the negative numbers ending at zero. That seems like an absurd task, since before you could count any number, you would already have to have counted an infinite number of prior numbers. And if you could count down from infinity, then why did you only finish today? Why not yesterday or the day before? At any point in the past, you've already had an infinite amount of time to finish your countdown, and therefore you should already be done. These sorts of absurdities suggest that an actually infinite past is impossible. Moreover, in one of the most startling developments of modern science, we now have pretty strong evidence that the universe is not eternal in the past, but had an absolute beginning about 14 billion years ago in a cataclysmic event known as the Big Bang. In 2003, Arvind Bord, Alan Guth, and Alexander Vilenkin were able to show that any universe, which is on average in a state of cosmic expansion throughout its history, cannot be infinite in the past, but must have a beginning. In 2012, Vilenkin showed that models which do not meet this one condition still fail for other reasons to avert the beginning of the universe. Vilenkin concluded none of these scenarios can actually be past eternal. All the evidence we have says that the universe had a beginning. The Bord-Guth-Vilenkin theorem proves that classical space-time cannot be extended to past infinity, but must reach a boundary at some point in the finite past. Now, either there was something on the other side of that boundary or not. If not, then that boundary just is the beginning of the universe. If there was something on the other side, then it will be a region described by the yet-to-be-discovered quantum theory of gravity. In that case, Vilenkin says, it will be the beginning of the universe. Either way, the universe began to exist. Since something cannot come into being out of nothing, the absolute beginning of the universe implies the existence of a transcendent cause of the universe. We can summarize our argument thus far as follows. 1. The universe began to exist. 2. If the universe began to exist, then the universe has a transcendent cause. 3. Therefore, the universe has a transcendent cause. Now, from the very nature of the case as the cause of space and time, this cause must be an uncaused, changeless, timeless, and immaterial being which created the universe. Now, there are only two possible candidates that could fit such a description: either an abstract object, like a number, or an unembodied mind. But abstract objects don't stand in causal relations. The number 7, for example, can't cause anything. Therefore, it follows that the transcendent cause of the universe is an unembodied mind. And thus we are brought not merely to an uncaused cause of the universe, but to its personal creator. Number 2, the fine-tuning of the universe for intelligent life. In recent decades, scientists have been stunned by the discovery that the initial conditions in the Big Bang were fine-tuned for the existence of intelligent life with a precision and delicacy that literally defy human comprehension. This fine-tuning is of two sorts. First, when the laws of nature are expressed as mathematical equations, you find appearing in them certain constants, like the gravitational constant. These constants are not determined by the laws of nature. Second, in addition to these constants, you find certain arbitrary quantities which are just put in as initial conditions on which the laws of nature operate. For example, the amount of entropy in the universe. Now, all of these constants and quantities fall into an extraordinarily narrow range of life-permitting values. Were these constants or quantities to be altered by less than a hair's breadth, the delicate life-permitting balance would be destroyed and life could not exist. We now know that life-prohibiting universes are incomprehensibly more probable than any life-permitting universe. Now, there are three possible explanations of this extraordinary fine-tuning: physical necessity, chance, or design. Now, it can't be due to physical necessity because, as we've seen, the constants and quantities are independent of the laws of nature. So, could the fine-tuning be due to chance? Well, the problem here is that the odds that all the constants and quantities would fall by chance into the tiny life-permitting zone are so infinitesimal that they cannot be reasonably faced. Therefore, the proponents of chance have been forced to recur to a remarkable metaphysical hypothesis, the multiverse. According to this hypothesis, there exists an infinite number of randomly ordered, unseen parallel universes, so that by chance alone, finely tuned universes would appear somewhere in the ensemble. There are many problems with the multiverse hypothesis as an explanation of fine tuning, but let me highlight one of the most important. If our universe were just a random member of a multiverse, then we ought to be observing a much different universe than we do. Roger Penrose of Oxford University has pressed this objection forcefully. He points out that the odds of our universe's initial low entropy conditions existing by chance alone are 1 chance out of 10 to the power of 10 to the power of 123. By contrast, the odds of our solar systems suddenly forming by the random collision of particles is 1 chance out of 10 to the power of 10 to the power of 60. This number, says Penrose, is utter chicken feed in comparison with 10 to the 10 to the 123. What that means is that it is far more likely that we should be observing an orderly patch no larger than our solar system. For a universe like that is unfathomably more probable than a fine-tuned universe like ours. In fact, the most probable observable universe is one which consists of a single brain which fluctuates into existence by a random fluctuation with illusory perceptions of the external world. So, if you accept the multiverse hypothesis, you're obligated to believe that you are all that exists, and that this auditorium, your body, the earth, and everything you perceive are just illusions of your brain. No sane person believes such a thing. On atheism, therefore, it is highly improbable that there exists a randomly ordered multiverse. With the failure of the multiverse hypothesis, the alternative of chance collapses. Neither physical necessity nor chance provides a good explanation of the fine-tuning of the universe. Therefore, the best explanation is design. And thus, the fine-tuning of the universe implies the existence of a designer of the cosmos. Number three, the existence of objective moral values and duties in the world. Our first two arguments give us a creator and designer of the universe, But they don't tell us anything about his moral character. How can we know that he is good? My third argument addresses that question. Premise one states, if God did not exist, objective moral values and duties would not exist. On a naturalistic view, moral values are just the byproduct of biological evolution and social conditioning. Just as a troop of baboons exhibit cooperative and even self-sacrificial behavior because natural selection has determined that it is advantageous in the struggle for survival, so their primate cousins, Homo sapiens, exhibit similar behavior for the same reason. As a result of socio-biological pressures, there has evolved among Homo sapiens a sort of herd morality which functions well in the perpetuation of our species. But on the atheistic view, there doesn't seem to be anything about Homo sapiens that makes this morality objectively binding and true. But that leads to our second premise. Objective moral values and duties do exist. In moral experience, we apprehend a realm of moral values and duties that impose themselves upon us. Now, that does not imply that our moral experience is infallible, but only that it is not wholly delusory. Our apprehension of the moral realm is analogous to our apprehension of the physical realm. Just as in the absence of some defeater, we are rational to accept the fallible deliverances of our senses that there really is a world of physical objects around us, so too, in the absence of some defeater, we are rational to accept the deliverances of our moral apprehensions. And there is no such defeater. As philosopher Louise Anthony so nicely puts it, any argument for moral skepticism is going to be based upon premises which are less obvious than the existence of objective moral values themselves. Actions, like the terrorist attacks in London yesterday, aren't just socially unacceptable behavior. Some things, at least, are truly evil. But if any objective moral values and duties exist, then it follows logically and inescapably that three, therefore, God exists. Number four, the historical facts concerning Jesus of Nazareth. The historical person, Jesus of Nazareth, was a remarkable individual. Historians have reached something of a consensus that Jesus came on the scene with an unprecedented sense of divine authority, with the authority to stand and speak in God's place. He claimed that in himself the kingdom of God had come, and as visible demonstrations of this fact, he carried out a ministry of miracle working and exorcisms. But the supreme confirmation of his claim was his resurrection from the dead. If Jesus did rise from the dead, then it would seem that we have a divine miracle on our hands, and thus evidence for the existence of God. Now, most people probably think that the resurrection of Jesus is something you just believe in by faith or not. But there are actually three facts recognized by the majority of historians today, which I believe are best explained by the resurrection of Jesus. Fact number one, on the Sunday after his crucifixion, Jesus' tomb was found empty by a group of his women followers. According to Jakob Kramer, an Austrian specialist, by far most scholars hold firmly to the reliability of the biblical statements about the empty tomb. Fact number two, on separate occasions, different individuals and groups of people experienced appearances of Jesus alive after his death. According to the prominent German New Testament critic Gert Ludemann, it may be taken as historically certain that the disciples had experiences after Jesus' death in which Jesus appeared to them as the risen Christ. These appearances were witnessed not only by believers, but also by unbelievers, skeptics, and even enemies. Fact number three, the original disciples suddenly came to believe that Jesus rose from the dead despite having every predisposition to the contrary. First century Jews had no belief in a Messiah who would be defeated and executed by his enemies. And Jewish beliefs about the afterlife precluded anyone's rising from the dead to glory and immortality before the end of the world. Nevertheless, the original disciples came to believe so strongly that God had raised Jesus from the dead that they were willing to die for the truth of that belief. N.T. Wright, an eminent New Testament scholar, concludes, "That is why, as a historian, I cannot explain the rise of early Christianity unless Jesus rose again, leaving an empty tomb behind him." Attempts to explain away these three great facts, like the disciples stole the body or Jesus wasn't really dead, have been universally rejected by contemporary scholarship. The simple fact is that there just is no plausible, naturalistic explanation of these facts. And therefore, it seems to me, the Christian is amply justified in believing that Jesus rose from the dead and was who he claimed to be. But that entails that God exists. And thus, we have a good inductive argument for the existence of God based on the resurrection of Jesus. Finally, number five, the personal experience of God. This isn't really an argument for God's existence. Rather, it's the claim that you can know that God exists wholly apart from arguments, simply by personally experiencing him. This was the way that people in the Bible knew God. As Professor John Hick explains, God was known to them as a dynamic will, interacting with their own wills, a sheer given reality, as inescapably to be reckoned with as destructive storm and life-giving sunshine. To them, God was not an idea adopted by the mind, but an experienced reality which gave significance to their lives. Now, if this is the case, then there's a danger that arguments for God could actually distract your attention from God himself. If you're sincerely seeking God, then God will make his existence evident to you. We mustn't so focus on the arguments that we fail to hear the voice of God speaking to our own heart. For those who listen, God becomes a personal reality in their lives. In conclusion, then, we've seen five good reasons to think that God exists. God is the best explanation of the origin of the universe. God is the best explanation of the fine-tuning of the universe for intelligent life. God is the best explanation of objective moral values and duties in the world. God is the best explanation of the historical facts concerning the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus. And God can be personally known and experienced. If Dr. Kame wants us to believe that God does not exist, then he must first tear down all five of the reasons that I presented, and then in their place build a case of his own to show that God does not exist. Unless and until he does that, I think that theism is the more plausible worldview.
So it's, which one do I press? So it's that one to go to the next. Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here to debate this most important of questions, and it's an honour to be sharing the stage with perhaps the world's foremost apologist for Christian theism. I've followed and admired Dr. Craig's work for several years now, and I'm looking forward to what I'm sure is going to be a vigorous exchange of ideas. I'd like to begin by saying something about why I'm here. I'm an atheist, and tonight I'll be arguing for atheism, but I'm not a committed atheist. and nor am I what's sometimes called an anti-theist, that is, someone who thinks not only is theism false, but positively harmful. I'm not a committed theist nor an anti-theist, because I don't regard atheism as a position that I'm particularly invested in, or as a position that I particularly want to hold or for other people to hold. On the contrary, I quite like to believe some version of theism. And there are quite a few other supernatural claims that I'd like to believe as well. For example, I'd particularly like to believe that I'll come back to life after my bodily death. In fact, I often find myself rather envying religious believers and how wonderful it must be to sincerely believe that the universe is governed by an all-powerful, all-good creator, and most wonderful of all, that after death we're reunited for eternity with our loved ones. So being someone who would actually rather like to agree with Dr. Craig, I'm not here tonight because I have a desire to convince religious believers that they're wrong, even though I think they are. And I certainly have no expectation that at the end of tonight's debate, any religious believers in the audience, after hearing my arguments for atheism, are going to go home saying, "Silly me, God doesn't exist after all." Nor do I even have any real desire to be proved right. On the contrary, I'd actually rather like to be proved wrong. And it's because I quite like theism to be true, I suppose, that at various points in my life, I've actively, and I think sincerely, tried to cultivate some form of religious belief. But despite my best efforts, despite being intellectually open to theism, despite a considerable amount of honest reflection on the various arguments for the existence of God, and despite, as I say, having a strong desire for theism to be true, I'm sorry to say that I've never found any of the arguments persuasive or had any kind of religious experience of the sort that might lead me to embrace some form of theism. Now, these psychological facts about me, that I'm open to theism, that I fairly consider the evidence in its favour, and yet that I persist in a state of unbelief, actually suggest a rather simple, but I think quite powerful argument for atheism. Why the cosmic game of hide and seek? Why would a loving God, who supposedly wants all human beings to enter into a personal relationship with him, remain hidden from someone who sincerely seeks him? If such a being exists, then surely you'd expect there to be no non-believers like me. That is, non-believers who, in John Schellenberg's words, are non-resistant to religious belief and indeed have actively striven to cultivate it. Now, if that's right, then the fact that there are non-resistant non-believers like me constitutes good evidence for the non-existence of such a being. Now, of course, Dr. Craig might say that I can't have been sincere in my efforts to cultivate belief. But he really has no non-question-begging reason to back those sorts of claims up. And by that I mean that the only way he could reasonably deny that I'm in a state of non-resistant non-belief would be to beg the question by assuming from the outset that God exists, and that since God's existence is incompatible with the existence of non-resistant non-believers, it must be the case that all non-belief is actually resistant non-belief. Now, I think it would be reasonable to suppose that some non-believers are resistant to religious belief, and so, whether consciously or unconsciously, hide from themselves the reasons that might be adduced in support of religious belief. But Dr. Craig would need to make the much stronger claim that all non-believers, including those like me who claim to be open to theism, are in fact in a state of rebellion, that is, as having consciously or unconsciously chosen to close the door on the possibility of a relationship with God. Now, I think that would be an implausibly strong claim for which there's no non-question-begging evidence. The fact is that there are lots of people like me who claim to be open to theism but are nonetheless non-believers, and I can think of no reason why we shouldn't take the testimony of non-resistant non-believers on face value. Alternatively, Dr. Craig might say that I haven't properly engaged with the arguments, or as he undoubtedly would claim, that I've made a mistake in my assessment of them. Dr. Craig obviously thinks that there are numerous sound arguments for God's existence. And since he regards those arguments as sound, he must think that anyone who's unpersuaded by them has made some kind of rational mistake. They must be rationally dysfunctional in some way. But as Dr. Craig himself is well aware, it's not only through the provision of external evidence and argument that God could make himself known to the non-resistant non-believer. As an omnipotent being, it would be an absolute cinch for him to provide me with direct experiential knowledge of his reality. And yet he chooses not to do so. So one of the things that I'd like to hear from Dr. Craig tonight is a plausible, non-question-begging explanation as to why God hasn't revealed himself to me and others like me. Now, Dr. Craig might say that while there are non-resistant non-believers like me, it's only a matter of time before God reveals himself. So in his podcast, Dr. Craig's podcast, not God's podcast, he's argued that the kind of non-resistant non-belief that I ascribe to myself is not incompatible with the existence of God. What is incompatible with the existence of God is what he calls persistent non-resistant non-belief. That is non-resistant belief that persists until death. So on Dr. Craig's view, if my characterization of my non-belief as non-resistant is accurate, then at some point prior to my death, God will reveal himself to me. And my response to this would simply be to ask Dr. Craig, why hasn't God already revealed himself to me? And surely God, given God's perfectly loving nature, and given that my coming into a personal relationship with God is supposedly the greatest good for me, you'd expect God, as an all-powerful, all-loving being, not to delay in delivering that great good to me. What would we think of a parent who said, I'm not going to have anything to do with my child for the first 40 years of his life? Well, we'd obviously be inclined to say that they fell short as a parent and that their love for their child was imperfect. So in other words, I think that Dr. Craig's attempt to sidestep the problem posed by non-resistant non-belief, but by saying that while temporary non-resistant non-belief is compatible with theism, persistent non-resistant non-belief is not compatible with theism, does nothing to mitigate the problem, since any kind of non-resistant non-belief, whether temporary or persistent, is incompatible with the existence of an omnipotent, perfectly loving being. Okay, I'd now like to say something about the argument from evil and why I think it provides good reasons for believing atheism to be true. And the argument from evil is, of course, an ancient argument, so I make no claim to originality here. In its simplest form, it asserts that since God is omnipotent and morally perfect, he should be both able and willing to prevent evil. Since there is evil in the world, such a being cannot or is unlikely to exist. Now, one of the traditional theistic responses to this sort of argument is to claim that God has morally sufficient reasons for allowing evil to occur, because evil is necessary for the existence of what are called outweighing goods. For example, courage, which we value, is only possible in a situation in which there is fear. Sympathy, which we value, is only possible in a situation in which there is suffering. Dignity in the face of adversity is only possible in a situation in which there is suffering. Now, I've never found this kind of response very persuasive, primarily because it's just highly implausible that the so-called outweighing goods really do outweigh the evils that make them possible. I mean, are we really supposed to believe that the evil of a small child dying of leukemia is outweighed by the sympathy that's expressed to the grieving parents, or by the fact that the parents are brought closer together by their shared suffering? Now, Dr. Craig might say that this is an emotional, not an intellectual reaction to such evils, but it seems to me that the strong emotional reaction such events or occurrences elicit is telling us something, that our emotions are in effect functioning cognitively here, and that this is exactly the kind of feature of our moral experience that Dr. Craig appeals to in the context of his moral argument when he says that we apprehend objective moral values in moral experience. That is, that we just see immediately that something is good or evil. But even if you think these evils really do outweigh the evils which make them possible, you're still going to be left with the problem of accounting for all the evil in the world that can't plausibly be said to be necessary for the achievement of some outweighing good. That's to say, there's plenty of evil in the world that appears to be entirely pointless or gratuitous. Let's say that an evil Let's say that an evil is pointless if and only if God lacks a morally sufficient reason for allowing it to occur. And let's say further that God lacks a morally sufficient reason for allowing an evil to occur, even only if he could have prevented it without thereby losing out on some outweighing good or preventing some equally bad or worse evil. So examples of pointless evil are an animal's dying an agonizing death in a forest fire, a baby that's born with a terminal illness that endures intense suffering and then dies after only a few days of life, a tsunami that wipes out many thousands of people, like the one that struck Southeast Asia on Boxing Day 2004 and killed in excess of 230,000. There's a profusion of apparently pointless evil in the world, from which, as I now want to claim, it follows that God probably does not exist. This argument, the argument from pointless evil, can be stated as follows. Premise one, necessarily, if God exists, there are no pointless evils. Premise two, probably there are pointless evils. Therefore, conclusion, probably God does not exist. As an instance of modus tollens, this is a logically valid argument. That's to say, the conclusion follows from the premises. Whether the conclusion is true, therefore, hinges on the truth of the premises. Now, the truth of premise one follows a priori from God's omnipotence, omniscience, and moral perfection. If God exists, then since he's morally perfect, he wouldn't act or fail to act unless he has a morally sufficient reason for doing so. And since he's omnipotent and omniscient, he'd be able to prevent any evil which isn't necessary for the achievement of an outweighing good or the avoidance of an equally bad or worse evil. It follows that if an omnipotent, omniscient, morally perfect being exists, there are no pointless evils. What about the second premise? Do pointless evils really exist? Well, the first thing I want to say about this premise is that it's meant to be a probabilistic claim. That's to say, I'm not claiming that we can know with certainty of any instance of apparently pointless evil, that it really is pointless. That's because with respect to any instance of apparently pointless evil, it's always going to be possible to say that it's logically possible that that instance of apparently pointless suffering was in fact, contrary to appearances, necessary for the achievement of some outweighing good, of which we're unaware. Some outweighing goods are easily identifiable for us. So, for example, the good of health that is achieved through some painful medical procedure. But it might be the case that the outweighing goods of which we're aware are not exhaustive of the outweighing goods that there are. Perhaps there are outweighing goods that are entirely cognitively inaccessible to us. And perhaps what appear to us to be pointless evils are in fact necessary for those outweighing goods of which we're unaware. And this response would be fine to the logical argument from evil, which claims that God and evil are logically incompatible. The mere logical possibility that what appear to us to be pointless evils are in fact necessary for the achievement of outweighing goods of which we're unaware is enough to show that God and evil are logically compatible. But I'm not claiming that God and evil are logically incompatible. I'm claiming that the existence of what appear to us to be pointless evils means that God probably doesn't exist. And the conclusion that God probably doesn't exist is probabilistic precisely because the claim that pointless evils exist is probabilistic. So I'm not claiming that we can know with certainty that there are pointless evils. I'm only claiming that we can know that it's probably the case that there are pointless evils. And that, in conjunction with the truth of premise one, is enough to establish the conclusion that God probably doesn't exist. So, what reasons are there for regarding premise two as true? Well, first, there's the fact that it appears to us that certain evils are pointless. That's to say, there are evils for which, even after very careful consideration, we can't discern any morally sufficient reason why God would allow them. Now, Dr. Craig standardly responds to this line of argument by claiming that human cognitive faculties are just too limited for us to be able to reasonably expect that we'd be able to fathom God's morally sufficient reasons for allowing apparently pointless suffering. given the vast distance between the human mind and God's mind, it just isn't reasonable to suppose that if God had a morally sufficient reason for permitting apparently pointless suffering, we'd be able to detect it. The fact that we can't detect God's morally sufficient reason only counts as a good reason for believing that God lacks such reasons if we have good reason for thinking we'd be able to detect his morally sufficient reason if he had one. And according to Dr. Craig, we don't have good reason for thinking we'd be able to detect God's morally sufficient reason if he had one. Now, at this point in his argument, Dr. Craig likes to invoke an analogy with chaos theory. Just as a butterfly flapping its wings in West Africa can set in motion a causal chain that leads to a hurricane over the Atlantic, so too, quote, the brutal murder of an innocent man or a child's dying of leukemia could produce a sort of ripple effect through history, such that God's morally sufficient reason for permitting it might not emerge until centuries later and perhaps in another land. When you think of God's providence over the whole of history, I think you can see how hopeless it is for limited observers to speculate on the probability that God could have a morally sufficient reason for permitting a certain evil. We're just not in a good position to assess such probabilities. Now, it's true that a child's dying of leukemia might have a ripple effect, and it's also true that we're not in a good position to assess such probabilities. But obviously that cuts both ways. For all we know, the child's dying of leukemia has no morally significant ripple effect. Or it might have a ripple effect that leads not to some outweighing good, but to further evil, perhaps even to a greater evil. Or it might lead to a ripple effect that has some good consequences, but not enough to constitute an outweighing good. So, putting this a bit more formally, we can say that, assuming that all events have a ripple effect, in respect of any instance of apparently pointless evil E, one of the following four propositions must be true. One, E has a ripple effect, leading to an outweighing good or the prevention of an equally bad or worse evil. Two, E has a ripple effect leading to a non-outweighing good. Three, E has a ripple effect leading to further evil. And four, E has a ripple effect that is morally neutral. Now note that of these four possibilities, we can say that E is not a pointless evil if and only if one is true. So unless one is true, E is a pointless evil. Now since by Dr. Craig's own admission, we're not in a position to assess the probabilities, it follows that 1 to 4 are equiprobable propositions. That is, each of the four possibilities has a probability of 1/4. Now, as I said, E is not a pointless evil if and only if 1 is true, from which it follows that the probability that E is not a pointless evil is 1/4, and the probability that E is a pointless evil is 3/4. Therefore, it's more probable than not that E is a pointless evil, therefore probably God does not exist. That completes my positive case for atheism. Obviously, I haven't said anything yet in response to Dr. Craig's own arguments, but I'll explain why I don't think any of them is successful in the first and second rebuttals. In Dr. Craig's rebuttal, as I said, I'm hoping that he'll be able to provide me with a non-question-begging explanation of why God doesn't reveal himself to me as a non-resistant non-believer. I'm also hoping to hear from Dr. Craig in his response to my argument from pointless evil, how, given his view that we're ignorant of the relevant probabilities of the ripple effects of apparently pointless evil, he thinks he can avoid the implication of that view that with respect to any instance of apparently pointless evil, it's more probable than not that it's more probable than not that it's not just an apparently pointless evil, but an actually pointless evil, from which, as I've argued, it follows that God probably doesn't exist. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We'll now move on to the next phase, which is the first rebuttal. So I'd like Dr. Craig to speak for 12 minutes.
Dr. Kim has not yet engaged any of my positive reasons to believe in God exists,
and I would suggest that even if his arguments succeed in showing some improbability in God's existence, it's simply outweighed by the five arguments that I presented for God's existence. But do his arguments, in fact, show that it's improbable that God exists? Well, as I see it, he has two basic arguments. First, one from the hiddenness of God, and secondly, one from the evil in the world. With respect to divine hiddenness, I think it's important to understand that God's primary aim is to draw people into a saving love relationship with himself, not just to convince people that God exists. If that's all that God were interested in, then he could certainly have made his existence more obvious. For example, he could have written God exists in the stars or planted a neon cross in the sky saying Jesus saves. But there's no guarantee at all that in such a world, this sort of display would draw more people into a saving love relationship with God. In fact, it might even have the opposite effect. After a while, people might begin to chafe under the brazen advertisements of their Creator and not to love him. The Bible says that God has provided sufficient evidence of his reality in nature and conscience, and by his Holy Spirit draws all persons to himself. As an omniscient being, he knows what would be most effective in drawing people freely into a saving love relationship with himself. What the atheist would have to prove is that a clearer revelation of God's existence would be more effective in drawing people freely into a saving love relationship than the way that God has in fact chosen. And that is pure speculation. Thus, there's simply no basis for thinking that divine hiddenness is an argument against God's existence. I might note as well that this really isn't an argument for atheism. It's an argument for universalism. It's to say that all persons should be saved. So even if you found the argument persuasive, it doesn't prove that God does not exist. It would just prove universalism is true. Well, what about then the problem of evil? Does evil disprove God's existence? Well, I think Dr. Kame admits that the logical version of the problem of evil is a failure. The atheist cannot prove that there is a logical incompatibility between the propositions God exists and evil exists. In order to show this, he would have to demonstrate that it is necessarily true that if God is all-powerful, he can create just any world that he wants, and if God is all good, then he would create a world without evil. And those propositions are not necessarily true. They lay a burden of proof on the atheist, which no one has been able to sustain. In fact, as long as it's even possible that God would have morally sufficient reasons for permitting the evil in the world, then it's possible that God and the evil in the world coexist. And so for this reason, the logical version of the problem of evil has been widely recognized by theist and atheist alike as bankrupt. Peter Van Inwagen, a prominent Christian philosopher, says it used to be held that evil was incompatible with the existence of God, that no possible world contained both God and evil. So far as I am able to tell, this thesis is no longer defended. So the question then is, does the evil in the world render God's existence improbable, if not impossible? Well, here I will simply defend the view that Dr. Kame already sketched, that given our cognitive limitations, we are simply not in a position to say with any sort of confidence, when some incidence of evil occurs, that God probably doesn't have a morally sufficient reason for permitting this. William Alston, in his article in Philosophical Perspectives, lists six such cognitive limitations which make it in principle impossible for us to make these kinds of probabilistic judgments. He says it is in principle impossible for us to be justified in supposing that God does not have sufficient reasons for permitting evil that are unknown to us. Take, for example, the illustration of the historical ripple effect. God's morally sufficient reason for permitting some evil to enter your life might not emerge until centuries from now, maybe in another country. When you think about the control of a provident God over the whole of human history, who sees the end from the beginning, you can see how hopeless it is for us finite, historically limited observers to speculate upon whether or not God has a morally sufficient reason for permitting some incident of suffering to enter our lives. So Alston says the judgments required by the probabilistic version of the problem of evil are of a very special and extraordinarily ambitious type, and our cognitive capacities are not equal to this one. We are simply not in a position to justifiably assert that God would have no sufficient reason for permitting evil. And if that is right, he says, the probabilistic argument from evil is in no better shape than the late lamented logical argument from evil. Now, Dr. Kane has a very interesting response to this consideration in his opening speech. He points out that there are four different possibilities that an event might have through the ripple effect it sends through history. It could make the evil worse, it could be morally neutral, it could have an outweighing good. Now, he concludes from that that therefore the probability of its having an outweighing good is only 1/4. That's logically fallacious. That argument violates probability theory. Consider a bag of marbles, and you don't know the color of the marbles in the bag. You might think, well, if I pick a marble from the bag, there's a 50% chance that it's red and a 50% chance it's not red, and so the chance of picking a red marble are 50%. Well, that's obviously fallacious because it could be blue marbles in the bag or green marbles in the bag. You simply cannot make any sort of probability estimate based upon that kind of blind calculation. Similarly here, there's no reason to think that the probability of the outweighing good is 1/4 or 25%. And this is particularly true if the world is under the providential control of an omnipotent and loving God who orders the universe so that evils have outweighing goods. It's not a matter of random chance. The hypothesis of theism is that God is in control of human history and so orders the world so that he has morally sufficient reasons for the evils that occur. So when we see an incident of evil in our lives, we have no idea of what its impact will be upon the world. Those probabilities are simply inscrutable, and therefore you cannot say either way whether that evil has an outweighing good or makes things worse. And if that's the case, then the atheist's argument from evil fails. Because remember, he has the burden of proof to show that it is improbable that God has a morally sufficient reason for permitting that evil. And he's not been able to shoulder that burden of proof. He's making probability judgments that are way beyond our capacity to make with any confidence. Finally, the third point I wanted to make in this regard is that evil actually proves God's existence. Yes, I think there's a good argument for God from evil. It goes like this. Premise one, if God does not exist, objective moral values do not exist. Two, evil exists. Three, therefore, objective moral values exist. Some things are evil, therefore God exists. So while on a superficial level, evil might seem to call into question God's existence, on a deeper philosophical level, evil actually proves God's existence because in the absence of God, nothing would be good or evil as such. And therefore, I'm not persuaded that the arguments from the evil in the world are at all compelling. Evil in the world is not logically incompatible with God's existence, and we're not in any position to say with any sort of confidence that the evils in the world are improbable with respect to God's existence. When we consider then the good arguments that we do have for God's existence, I think it becomes quite probable that God does exist, and that therefore theism remains the more plausible and probable worldview.
Thank you very much. And I now invite Dr. King to make this first remark.
So many of Dr. Craig's arguments for theism are what's called inference to the best explanation arguments. That's to say they take some difficult to account for phenomenon, such as the fine-tuning of the universe, the existence of objective moral values and duties and so on, and then argue that naturalism or physicalism can't account for that phenomenon, but that theism can account for it. So there are two general points that I want to make about this style of argument that Dr. Craig deploys. First of all, Dr. Craig usually makes the claim that the non-theistic explanations fail to account for the relevant phenomenon without really engaging with any of those explanations. For example, in the context of his moral argument, all we've been told, in effect, this evening is that there's no space for objective moral values in the naturalistic world of quarks and electrons. But this is just a bald assertion, right? And it ignores the many naturalistic theories of moral realism that are out there. So most contemporary moral realists, or rather, most contemporary moral philosophers are moral realists. And most contemporary moral philosophers are also atheists. So Dr. Craig is completely out of step with the majority of contemporary moral philosophers when he asserts that God is the only possible ontological foundation for objective moral values. Now that's not to say that the contemporary moral realists are right, it's just to say that Dr. Craig owes us an argument as to why they aren't right. Now of course it wouldn't be fair to demand of Dr. Craig that in the course of tonight's debate that he refute each of the vast number of naturalistic theories of moral realism that are out there. But Dr. Craig's position is usually not just that there is no good naturalistic explanation of the relevant phenomenon, but that there could be no naturalistic explanation of the relevant phenomenon. In other words, he holds that there's an in-principle reason why naturalism can't account for the phenomenon in question. That seems to be his position on objective moral values. So, in effect, Dr. Craig seems to say that either one is a theist, in which case one is somehow supposed to be able to ground objective moral values in God, or one is an atheist and therefore forced to embrace some form of moral nihilism. Similarly, in respect of the origins of the universe and the fine-tuning of the universe for intelligent life, either one accepts theism, in which case all of those phenomena are supposedly readily explicable, or one is a naturalist, in which case those phenomena are supposedly recalcitrant to explanation. So given that Dr. Craig seems to think that there's an in-principle reason why these various phenomena can't be explained naturalistically, he doesn't need to refute each of the various naturalistic theories that are out there. All he needs to do is tell us why there could be no naturalistic explanation of these various phenomena, which he claims can't be adequately explained by naturalism, but can be adequately explained only by theism. And until he does that, he's failed in his epistemic duty, and those naturalistic positions remain viable explanatory options of the relevant phenomena. And in any case, even if it were true that those various phenomena can't be explained in terms of naturalism, that fact alone wouldn't provide any positive evidence for the existence of an all-powerful, all-loving, all-knowing personal agent. That a given phenomenon can't be explained naturalistically implies only that some form of non-naturalism must be true. It doesn't imply that theism is true. The second point I want to make about Dr. Craig's inference to the best explanation arguments is that seeking to explain any natural phenomenon by saying God did it is no explanation at all. How did God do it? How did it work? Dr. Craig wants the theistic hypothesis to play the role of a physical theory that can explain things. He wants the theistic hypothesis to be considered among the live explanatory options for a whole range of physical and psychological phenomena that cosmologists and neuroscientists are busy trying to explain in naturalistic terms. Well, that means that the theistic hypothesis needs to meet the same criteria of explanatory adequacy that would be applied to a scientific hypothesis. That is, it should be judged in the same terms that we use to judge scientific hypotheses. And when judged in these terms, the God hypothesis doesn't do very well. A scientific explanation doesn't just tell you that something happened, it tells you how it happened. It identifies a sequence of events and a causal mechanism. The Big Bang theory, for example, doesn't just tell us that the universe started in a Big Bang, full stop. It gives us a timeline for the metric expansion of the universe that offers detailed measurements of the expansion rate of matter, explains how the universe expanded from a very high density and high temperature state, and it offers a comprehensive explanation of an abundance of observed phenomena, such as the cosmic background, microwave radiation, the large-scale structure of the universe, and so on. The theistic explanation of the origins of the universe, by contrast, just says some intelligent agent did something at some time, somewhere, somehow, to bring the universe into existence. Ditto with regard to the fine-tuning. In that case, as well, the theistic explanation amounts to little more than the assertion that God did it. No account is given as to the mechanism by means of which this is supposed to have happened. There's no specification of any law or rule in accordance with which God acts, nor is any account given of how an unembodied mind could causally interact with the physical world in the first place. I mean, you can utter the words, God caused the fine-tuning, or God grounds the existence of objective moral values, but I don't think theists really know what they're saying when they make statements like that about divine agency. How does God, as an unembodied mind, causally interact with the physical world? A good explanation is also consistent with our background knowledge, that is, with what we already know. So is theism consistent with our background knowledge? Well, as far as we know, affecting changes in the physical universe requires having a body. So seeking to explain moral objectivity or the fine-tuning of the universe in terms of the creative designs of an unembodied mind is arguably inconsistent with this piece of background knowledge. Indeed, the very idea of an unembodied mind is arguably inconsistent with our background knowledge that having a mind requires having a brain. Another thing scientists look for in a physical theory is predictive power. That's to say, they take their hypothesis and ask what we would expect the world to look like, or what observations we'd expect to make if the hypothesis were true. Well, are there any specific predictions that come out of the theistic hypothesis? Well, I don't think there are. Because God is omnipotent, he could do anything. And because he's mysterious and his purposes are unfathomable and so on, literally any observed state of affairs is consistent with the hypothesis. I mean, he's omnipotent, so there's nothing he can't do. So the range of possible actions that he might perform or changes in the material world that he might affect isn't constrained by what he's capable of doing. But nor can we say that the range of possible actions that he might perform or events that he'd allow to occur is constrained by what he desires, because his mind is supposedly unfathomable. And even if we say his mind isn't unfathomable, and that we know, for example, that he's morally perfect and all-loving, so will only allow things to happen that are good for us, well, that's compatible with just about any observed state of affairs, because, as we've seen in Dr. Craig's response to the argument from Pointless Evil, it will always be possible to say that of any instance of horrific suffering, that it is, contrary to appearances, necessary for the achievement of an outweighing good or the prevention of a greater evil. So theism doesn't entail any specific predictions. And when you put it like that, the God hypothesis starts to look like a paradigmatically bad explanation. Well, what about the fine-tuning argument? The first thing that I'd like to say here is that I think it's implausible to claim that the initial conditions of the universe were set up specifically in order to make intelligent life possible. The claim isn't that the initial conditions were set up in order to make human life possible. The claim is that the initial conditions were set up to make intelligent life possible. Now, I think that's implausible, given that by far the greatest part of the universe is dark, unimaginably cold, and utterly inhospitable to life. And the universe is almost entirely empty space. On current estimates, the total amount of matter in the universe makes up a tiny fraction of 1% of everything that exists in the universe. The common metaphor that we're like specks of dust is actually an insult to specks of dust. Seen in this context, the suggestion that the universe exists in order for intelligent life to exist is manifestly absurd. The second point I'd like to make relates to Dr. Gray's critique of the multiverse hypothesis. You'll remember that the fine-tuning argument presupposes that there's only one actual universe with one set of values for the fundamental constants, but it might be the case that there are, in fact, multiple universes with a wide range of values for the constants. So the multiverse hypothesis is supposed to make fine-tuning unsurprising via an argument along these sorts of lines. Since universes of practically all relevant types, both tuned and untuned, exist, it's unsurprising that some universe of our finely tuned type exists. Now, Dr. Craig's main argument against the multiverse hypothesis as an explanation of fine-tuning was that the multiverse leads to the Boltzmann brain problem. Now, Dr. Craig is absolutely right that Boltzmann brains pose a problem for the multiverse hypothesis, but as the cosmologist Sean Carroll pointed out in his debate with Dr. Craig in 2014, there are alternative viable models of the universe, of the multiverse, which avoid the Boltzmann brain problem. I mean, Dr. Craig gave the impression that all multiverse models lead to the Boltzmann brain problem, but that simply isn't the case. And so until he's explained why any of the alternative models, why none of the alternative models is viable, his rejection of the multiverse hypothesis is unwarranted.
Thank you. I invite Dr. Craig for the second rebuttal.
Before we look at my specific arguments for God's existence, let me respond to Dr. Kame's claim that God doesn't explain anything. Notice that some of my arguments are deductive. That is to say, if the premises are true, then the conclusion has to follow, whether you like it or not. For example, the argument from the beginning of the universe, or the argument from the existence of objective moral values. So that it doesn't matter whether you think it's explanatory or not, as long as the premises are true, the conclusion logically follows, and I think that in both cases the premises are true. Concerning the resurrection of Jesus, I think that this hypothesis passes the standard tests for inductive explanations, such as explanatory scope, explanatory power, plausibility, and so forth. God is of the order of a personal explanation. I am not offering alternative scientific theories for the origin of the universe or the fine-tuning. God is a personal explanation, and this is a legitimate form of explanation. Now let's look specifically at the question of the origin of the universe. Here, I didn't understand what Dr. Kame's response was. He doesn't deny that the universe began to exist. He doesn't deny that if the universe began to exist, there is a transcendent cause. All he asked was, well, what about naturalistic explanations? Well, there aren't any if the universe had an absolute beginning. Paul Davies writes, what caused the Big Bang? One might consider some supernatural force, some agency beyond space and time as being responsible for the Big Bang. Or one might prefer to regard the Big Bang as an event without a cause. It seems to me that we don't have too much choice. Either something outside the physical world or an event without a cause. But for something to come into existence from nothing is worse than magic, literally. So it seems to me much more plausible to think that there is a timeless, spaceless, immaterial, and personal creator of the universe, just as I argued. Now, with respect to the fine-tuning argument, Dr. Kamer has a number of objections. He says there's no account of the mechanism of the designer creating the world. Right. It's a personal explanation, a metaphysical explanation, not a scientific explanation. And design is a very familiar and common form of explanation for phenomena in life that we are called upon to explain. He says, but there it can not be an unembodied person. Well, I'd like to see him prove that. We're acquainted with ourselves, I think, as incorporeal, immaterial selves connected to a body. Reductive materialism doesn't work because moral properties are not identical with physical properties. For example, the brain is not sad or jubilant. And epiphenomenalism, or the view that the physical brain has mental properties, is incompatible with such phenomena as self-identity over time, intentional states, freedom of the will, and mental causation. So I think the best view of ourselves is some sort of dualism, interactionism, and I don't see any reason to think that if we are spiritual substances, souls in effect, or minds, that there cannot be a soul without a body. In fact, my arguments, if sound, prove that there is an unembodied mind, a transcendent unembodied mind, who created and designed the universe and is the source of moral values. Thirdly, Dr. Kame says that the design hypothesis is implausible because the universe is mostly empty. Well, I have 3 points in response to this. Number one, it's no part of the fine-tuning argument to say that human beings are the reason the universe was created. There could be conscious, intelligent life scattered throughout the cosmos. That's perfectly consistent with the argument. Secondly, in fact, the universe has to be as big as it is. It's a function of human life on this planet. In order for the stars to cook up the heavy elements of which our bodies are composed, the universe has to be as old as it is. But given that it's expanding, it therefore has to be as large as it is. And therefore, the size of the universe is actually a function of the existence of human beings. Thirdly, however, suppose God wants to create a magnificent large universe rather than a little universe. Suppose he wants to display his infinite glory and power. Who's to say he wouldn't do such a thing? The Bible says the heavens tell the glory of God, and the firmament proclaims his handiwork. I don't see any reason to think that if God exists, he has to create a little universe. Finally, Dr. Kame says that the multiverse hypothesis is defensible. I disagree. Postulating the existence of many worlds doesn't do anything to explain why we observe a world fine-tuned for embodied interactive agents. Unless you can prove that the vast preponderance of observable worlds are worlds that are finely tuned. But that can't be shown. There are observable worlds, like the Boltzmann brain world, which are not finely tuned. And so I do not think that the multiverse explanation succeeds. In order to prove the multiverse explanation, as Robin Collins points out, the detractor would have to show that there is a probability measure over different worlds in the multiverse that means that a significant proportion of the observable worlds are finely tuned worlds, and that simply cannot be done. So it seems to me that, again, the fine-tuning of the universe is best explained by design. If Dr. Kame doesn't think it's design, what's he going to defend? Physical necessity? Chance? He's not offered any reason to think that those alternatives are more plausible than the design hypothesis. Finally, what about the moral argument for God's existence? Here I want to emphasize the need of an explanation in morality. Paul Kurtz, the humanist philosopher, has said, "The central question about moral and ethical principles concerns their ontological foundation. If they are neither derived from God nor anchored in some transcendent ground, are they purely ephemeral?" And I cannot see any explanation on atheism for an ontological grounding of moral values. These non-theistic ethical theories that he speaks of typically just begin with the assumption that human beings have intrinsic moral value. And given that assumption, one can then work out an ethical system with which the theist will largely agree. But on atheism, that assumption seems questionable. Machines don't have intrinsic moral worth. But on the atheistic view, that's all we are, just biological machines. As one naturalist puts it, moist robots. And so I don't see any reason to regard human beings as a source of objective moral values. It's arbitrary and implausible. It's especially difficult to find any basis for moral duty in the absence of God.
Okay, I'd like to say something briefly about the argument from religious experience. Dr. Craig admits that this isn't an argument for theism. Well, if it's not an argument, then don't say it. I mean, it doesn't have any place in a debate on the existence of God, and it has no more epistemic weight in the discussion than my saying that I have a powerful and overwhelming sense of God's absence in the world. Dr. Craig maintains that the person to whom God reveals himself, or for the person to whom God reveals himself, that person can know with complete confidence that theism is true because of the witness that the Holy Spirit bears to him. Well, the problem is that there's just no way of knowing whether that such an experience really is veridical. Dr. Craig maintains that some kinds of experience are just so powerful and overwhelming that the subject requires no confirmation of the reliability of the experience. But of course, that feeling of indubitability can also accompany dreams, hallucinations, and psychotic delusions. And so it utterly fails to provide any kind of epistemic warrant. It's also, of course, the case that people of all faiths report religious experience of the kind that Dr. Craig describes. But since these faiths are mutually incompatible, that's to say only one of them can be true, it follows that the felt indubitability of the experience is misleading in at least all but one case. And that means that for anyone who is subject of such an experience, that they have very good reasons to be skeptical that it's veridical. I also think that religious experience is an implausible candidate for a properly basic belief. A properly basic belief, like our belief in the reality of the physical world or the existence of other minds, is a belief that's universal among psychologically healthy human beings, and it's a belief that it's impossible sincerely to doubt. But of course, religious belief isn't like that at all. Religious belief is neither universal among human beings nor impossible to doubt. Plenty of people don't believe in God, and even the most committed religious believers can go through periods of doubt. Religious believers lose their faith as well, but psychologically healthy people don't lose their belief in the reality of the external world or the existence of other minds. One more comment about the moral argument that I'd like to make. The main problem with this argument is, as I've said, the first premise: if God doesn't exist, objective moral values and duties don't exist. Now, that claim is logically equivalent to the claim that God is the only possible ontological foundation for objective moral values. As I said in my first rebuttal, in making this claim, Dr. Craig is out of step with the vast majority of contemporary moral philosophers who hold that moral objectivity doesn't depend on God. What's more, we've not been given any real argument as to why this extremely controversial claim that objective moral values are impossible without God is true. But not only has Dr. Craig failed to demonstrate that without God, objective moral values and duties are impossible, nor has he explained how objective moral values and duties could be grounded in God in the first place. The account of the relationship but supposed to obtain between God and objective moral values that Dr. Craig has outlined in his podcast and in his published writings is that objective moral values and duties are rooted in God's nature. God, Dr. Craig says, is the standard of goodness. His character is the paradigm of goodness, and his commands are expressions of his divine nature. Well, we might accept that these commands flow necessarily from God's nature, but we can still ask why commands that flow from God's nature rather than anyone else's should be seen as constitutive of morality. What's so special about God? What is it about God's nature such that the commands that flow from it are morality constituting? Sure, God is much more powerful, has much more knowledge than any human agent, but those facts, that he has those attributes to a greater degree than any human agent, shed no light whatsoever on why his commands should be constitutive of morality. God also has a very special metaphysical status, of course. He's creator and sustainer of the universe, but how is that supposed to be morally relevant? In short, what's missing from Dr. Craig's account is an account of the morality constituting force of God's nature. What about the Kalam cosmological argument? First of all, a comment on premise one, the claim that whatever begins to exist has a cause. Now, Dr. Craig offers a variety of reasons in support of this premise. He says that it's based on a metaphysical intuition that something can't just pop into being from nothing. But I don't think that's so much an argument for the claim that everything that begins to exist has a cause as simply a reiteration of the claim. That's to say that nothing comes into being from nothing is really just equivalent to saying that everything that begins to exist has a cause. And if it's equivalent to that, then it's not non-question begging. So that's not really an argument in support of the first premise, but rather simply a restatement of the premise. Dr. Craig also says in support of the first premise that the idea that things can just pop into existence is worse than magic. Well, I think that's a strange proposition for a theist to appeal to, since the theistic explanation of the origins of the universe in terms of God's willing the universe to exist is, of course, itself just a type of magic. And in any case, that something could come from nothing is no more mysterious to me than that all the matter and energy in the universe could be brought into existence by an unembodied immaterial mind. What about premise two, that the universe began to exist? Well, this might indeed be true, but Dr. Craig treats this premise as though it were a settled debate in contemporary cosmology, which it certainly isn't. There are numerous models which don't imply an absolute beginning of the universe, and of those, many don't require a cause. Now, Dr. Craig cites the Borg-Guth-Vilenkin theorem as his main piece of scientific evidence for the truth of this premise, and he quotes Alex Vilenkin, one of the authors of the Borg-Guth-Vilenkin theorem, who does indeed hold that the universe probably had a beginning. But what do the other authors of the Borg-Guth-Vilenkin theorem think? Do they hold that the theorem entails that the universe had a beginning? Well, in order to find out, a few days ago I sent Alan Guth an email in which I asked him, does the Borg-Guth-Vilenkin theorem, in his opinion, entail that the universe had a beginning? And his response was, quote, "I think that the BGV theorem does not entail that the universe had a beginning. It is the region of inflation that must have a beginning, not the universe." All I want to say about that is that if one of the authors of the Borg-Guth-Vilenkin theorem holds that it doesn't prove that the universe had a beginning, then that provides good reasons for being skeptical that it does. And since the Borg-Guth-Vilenkin theorem is the main reason Dr. Craig offers for accepting this first premise, that skepticism carries over to Dr. Craig's premise as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And so now we come to the closing section of the debate, and I invite Dr. Craig to make his closing remarks.
Well, I hope you've enjoyed the debate this evening as much as I have. Certainly, there's been a very interesting airing of the issues. First, consider my first contention that there are good reasons to believe that God exists. Number one, the origin of the universe. Here, Dr. Kame seems to be willing to embrace the view that the universe sprang into being out of nothing, which I think is metaphysically absurd. He says, if theism is like magic, well, then that reinforces my point that atheism is worse than magic. According to theism, there is an efficient cause of the origin of the universe, but no material cause. On atheism, there is neither an efficient nor a material cause, which strikes me as doubly absurd. He says the Borg-Guth-Vilenkin theorem does not require a beginning of the universe. I simply disagree, and if he thinks that it doesn't, then I invite him to give me a successful beginningless model of the universe. Alexander Vilenkin in 2012 writes that there are no models at this time that provide a satisfactory model for a universe without a beginning. In the fall of 2015, he strengthened that statement. We have no viable models of an eternal universe. The Born-Guth-Vilenkin theorem gives reason to believe that such models simply cannot be constructed. And in any case, don't forget the philosophical arguments that I gave against the infinitude of the past, which do not rely upon scientific information. So I think we've got good grounds for believing that the universe is not past eternal, as atheists have always claimed, but came into being a finite time ago, which points to a transcendent personal creator. Secondly, as for the fine-tuning argument, I answered Dr. Kame's objections concerning an unembodied personal cause, the size of the universe, the multiverse, and he did not respond to any of my points in my last speech. I think the fine-tuning argument, therefore, goes through successfully for a designer. As for the moral argument for God's existence, I emphasize the importance of having an ontological foundation that is adequate for morality. And he asked, well, what is so special about God in this regard? God is a better explanation for objective moral values and duties because stopping with God is less arbitrary and it is more plausible than just stopping with human beings. God is metaphysically ultimate, whereas human beings on atheism are just electrochemical machines that don't seem to have intrinsic moral value. Moreover, God is a more plausible candidate for the explanatory ultimate because God is by definition a being who is worthy of worship and therefore must be perfectly good. Indeed, as the greatest conceivable being, God would be the good rather than just be good. So that I think that theism provides a far more plausible and less arbitrary foundation for the affirmation of the objective moral values and duties we both want to affirm. Number four, unfortunately in tonight's debate, the resurrection of Jesus has gone undiscussed. That gives good reason for thinking Christian theism is true. As for the experience of belief in God, Dr. Kame says, how do you know it's veridical? The point is that you are justified in believing your experience is veridical unless and until you have a defeater of that experience. And we haven't heard any such defeater tonight. We've heard no reason to think that believers are delusory in their religious experience. He says, but it cannot be a properly basic belief because it doesn't have marks of universality and so forth. Properly basic beliefs include a wide range of beliefs, such as memory beliefs or beliefs based on testimony. And therefore, having belief in God in a properly basic way, it seems to me, is quite legitimate. God can be known simply through personal experience. My second contention was that there aren't comparably good arguments for atheism. We talked about the hiddenness of God, and I explained that God's purpose is not simply to make us add another item of furniture to our ontological inventory, but to bring us to know him, and the atheist would have to show that in a world in which God's existence was more obvious, more people would come to a saving knowledge of God, which is just pure conjecture. As for the problem of evil, I showed that neither the logical version goes through, and that Dr. Kame's version of the probabilistic argument from evil was actually logically fallacious and makes a misstep in probability theory. So in conclusion, I do not think we've seen comparably good arguments for atheism, whereas we have good plausibility arguments for theism, and that is why I am enthusiastically and unapologetically a Christian theist.
Okay, so I'd like to finish this evening by saying something about the burden of proof and where I think it lies in the discussion. So I've presented two arguments in tonight's debate for atheism, but in fact I don't think I was under any obligation to present any arguments since the burden of proof in this discussion lies entirely with the theist. Now, Dr. Craig would maintain that the burden of proof is shared equally by the atheist, since the atheist claims to know something. He claims to know that God doesn't exist, and therefore atheism, like theism, is a truth claim and so requires justification. Well, I agree that atheism is a truth claim and so requires justification, but the justification of a belief can take different forms. And sometimes a belief can be justified by demonstrating simply that the evidence for its falsehood is insufficient. So take, for example, my belief that werewolves don't exist. I don't have a proof that werewolves don't exist. Does that mean that my belief that werewolves don't exist is unjustified? Does that mean that I should be agnostic about the existence of werewolves? Well, obviously not. Even though I don't have a sound argument for the non-existence of werewolves, I'm well within my epistemic rights to believe that werewolves don't exist. Well, how can this be the case? Well, the lack of evidence for the existence of werewolves is itself the justification of my belief. If there's no reason to believe in werewolves, that is reason to believe that werewolves don't exist. Well, in reply to that sort of argument, Dr. Craig quotes the following slogan: the absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. And he sometimes spells this out in terms of a legal analogy. So the fact that the suspect's fingerprints are not on the murder weapon is not itself evidence that the suspect isn't the murderer. Indeed, the complete absence of evidence doesn't mean that the suspect isn't the murderer. Now, that is, of course, true. The complete absence of evidence is logically compatible with the suspect being the murderer. But the question isn't what is logically compatible with a complete absence of evidence. The question is what it's rational to believe in the complete absence of evidence. And from the complete absence of evidence that the suspect is the murderer, two things follow about what it's rational to believe about the suspect. Firstly, it follows that it's not rational to believe that the suspect is guilty. And secondly, it follows that it's rational to believe that the suspect is innocent. So similarly, in respect of belief in God, in the complete absence of any compelling evidence, that is, if none of the arguments for God's existence is in the final analysis successful, then it follows that firstly, it's not rational to believe that God exists, and secondly, it's rational to believe that God doesn't exist. Now, Dr. Craig is prepared to admit that in certain contexts, the absence of evidence is evidence of absence, and he stipulates two conditions under which absence of evidence is evidence of absence. The first condition is that we fully examine the area where the evidence should be found, and the second condition is that if the entity did exist, then we'd expect to have more evidence of its existence than that which we have. Now, it seems to me that that just amounts to tacit acceptance that the theist bears the burden of proof. If we translate the first condition, that we fully examined the area where the evidence should be found, to the question of the existence of God, as Dr. Craig himself says, that will mean you have done a thorough and in-depth investigation of the arguments of natural theology for God's existence. In other words, for the first condition to be met, the atheist must have thoroughly assessed the arguments for God's existence. What about the second condition? Well, here, when it's translated to the question of God's existence, this means that, quote, if God existed, we should have more evidence of his existence than that which we do have. And Dr. Craig then asks, is that true? If there were a God, we have more evidence of his existence than the existence of a contingent universe, the beginning of the universe at some point in the finite past, the fine-tuning of the universe, and so on. Should we have more evidence than that, he asks? Well, obviously the answer to that question is going to depend on how persuasive you find all these arguments. If you can show that these arguments are in fact unsound, then clearly the answer is going to be yes, we should have more evidence than that. So it's possible for the atheist to satisfy both conditions, and therefore for it to be the case that with respect to God's existence, the absence of evidence is evidence of absence. And that means that on Dr. Craig's own account, the burden of proof lies exclusively with the theist. In any case, I provided two arguments for atheism in tonight's debate, even though I didn't need to, and I actually don't think we've heard a convincing response to either of them from Dr. Craig this evening. I've argued that the existence of non-resistant non-believers is incompatible with the existence of an omnipotent, perfectly loving being, and I've argued that given that it's more probable than not that there are pointless evils in the world, it's more probable than not that God doesn't exist. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Now it's time.
Okay, so now it's your turn. We have about 30 minutes Q&A. There are going to be two mics available to amplify the questions. And the way we're going to run the Q&A is that first, would you please identify the main speaker that you'd like to direct your question towards? That person will speak first, and then the other speaker can kind of add on whatever they want to say. And the second thing is just please to ensure that you actually are asking a question as speeches from the floor are not permitted. So ask a question, please, and not a speech. So do we have mics? Okay. So, and please show your hand to indicate a question. Okay, so one question up there. Yeah. Okay, maybe stand up and just...
Could you repeat it again, more loudly and slowly,
yes,
please?
No problem. So you said that God controls human history and destiny. And if that's true, what outweighs the murders of 6 million Jews?
Of course, we don't know exactly what God's morally sufficient reason was for permitting the Holocaust. But there's no way that the atheist can prove that God did not have a morally sufficient reason for permitting this evil. That doesn't mean it was good. To say that God permitted it doesn't mean that this was good that this happened. But it's saying that God allowed the National Socialists in Germany to exercise their free will to do evil. And there may be some sort of morally sufficient reason for allowing that to occur. The atheist is the one who has the burden of proof here to show that God cannot or does not have such a burden of proof. It may be that the Holocaust was instrumental in the founding of the State of Israel, that only such an unprecedented atrocity would have led the nations of the world to return the Jews to their homeland in Palestine. And who knows how God may use the nation of Israel to bless the world. The Bible says that God has plans for Israel to bless the entire world through the nation of Israel. And it may well be that people will look back on those who perished in the Holocaust the way Christians look on the early martyrs in the church. The blood of the martyrs was the seed of the church from which it sprang. And it may well be that future Israelis will look back with gratitude on those who gave their lives in the Holocaust for the state of Israel and for the blessings to the world that God will bring through the state of Israel. Again, we just don't know. The point is that the atheist is assuming a burden of proof here by making probability judgments that are way beyond our ability to make with any confidence.
Okay. Dr. Penn.
Well, I think the example of the Holocaust very well illustrates the inadequacy of the theistic response to such events. I mean, to say that for all we know, the Holocaust was actually for the best, that for all we know, God does have a morally sufficient reason for allowing such events, is just implausible. As I said in my argument, my presentation of the argument from evil, it is true that such events could have a ripple effect, such that they lead to an outweighing good. Although in the case of the Holocaust, of course, it's very difficult to imagine what that outweighing good would be. But the mere logical possibility, because I think that's all it is, the mere logical possibility that such events could have a ripple effect leading to an outweighing good isn't sufficient to undermine our very rational and natural judgment that such events probably don't have a morally sufficient reason, that such events probably don't lead to outweighing goods. We don't know what the long-term effects of such events will be. We don't know what the ripple effects are, but we do know what the immediate and short-term effects are. We do know that such events are great evils, and that, I think, is sufficient for the judgment that such events are probably pointless
okay.
evils.
So, second question then.
Professor Keane, I'd just like to ask, what would prove God to you? And, you know, as you said, personal religious beliefs can be delusions. As a result, what standard of proof should the theist provide in order for you to become a believer?
Yeah, I don't think religious belief, or religious experience rather, provides a good basis for religious belief, because I think the fact that people of all faiths report religious experiences and those faiths are mutually incompatible, that only one of them can be true. So anyone who has a religious experience therefore has a good reason to be skeptical that their experience is reliable. As to what would convince me, well, a sound argument for the existence of God would convince me. Compelling empirical evidence for the existence of God. Burning crosses in the sky, were it to be discovered by particle physicists that the words made by Jesus were inscribed on every subatomic particle, that would make me change my mind.
Okay.
I think that it's hard to imagine better evidence for the existence of God than things like the absolute beginning of the universe, the fine-tuning of the universe for intelligent life, a realm of objective moral values and duties, the resurrection of Jesus from the dead. Surely God has given us sufficient reason to believe that he exists. And I want to emphasize once again that Dr. Kame's argument that of these four possibilities of the outcome of an evil event, that the probability is therefore only one-fourth that it's good, that is a fallacious argument. If I told you I have a bag of marbles with four colors, red, yellow, green, and blue, and you pick a random marble, does that mean that your chance of getting a yellow marble is one-fourth? No, all of the marbles could be blue or red, or there could be any distribution. We just don't know. It's inscrutable. And so that argument is just demonstrably fallacious.
Okay, two more questions down here. So. You too.
Yeah. Hi, this is for Dr. Craig. You drew an epistemic boundary for us to presume upon the will of God. If this is the case, I think this is specifically because there's nothing in our nature comparable to omniscience or atemporality, etc. Well, then how do you justify your argument for the absurdity of an actual infinite, us being finite thinkers?
Okay, how do I justify what?
Your argument for the absurdity of an actual infinite existing, us being finite thinkers. Surely
so
we
are you saying that my argument against the existence of actual infinites is incompatible with belief in the infinity of God? Is that the idea?
Yes. Okay. Or an actual infinity existing in a causative chain, because surely there's an epistemic boundary there for us.
Now, okay, you tell me if I'm responding to your question. When I say that an actually infinite number of things cannot exist, I'm using a mathematical concept of infinity, a quantitative notion. In infinite set theory, an actual infinite is composed of an infinite number of definite and discrete elements. But when theologians talk about God's infinity, it's not a quantitative mathematical concept. It's a qualitative infinity. It means God is morally perfect, omnipotent, omniscient, eternal, and so forth. And so there isn't any composition in God of an actually infinite number of definite and discrete elements. So as long as we understand this difference between quantitative mathematical infinity and qualitative infinity, I think you can see there's no incompatibility between saying there cannot be an actually infinite number of things, and therefore there cannot be an actually infinite regress of events into the past, and yet saying God is infinite in the qualitative sense of being morally perfect, omnipotent, omniscient, omnipresent, and so forth.
Okay. Dr. Kame?
Well, I think there are problems for Dr. Craig's argument for the impossibility of an actual infinite posed by God's infinity. I mean, if God is omniscient, then he knows all true propositions. Now, suppose, for the sake of discussion, that the universe is physically infinite, or that the future is physically, the future is infinite. Well, it follows that he knows an infinite number of truths about the physical universe, an infinite number of truths about the future of the universe. So in that sense, I think God does actually instantiate an actual infinite. So one other thing I'd like to say about Dr. Craig's philosophical arguments for the impossibility of an actual infinite are that I think all that they really show is that the notion of an actual infinite leads to counterintuitive results. The notion of a natural infinite doesn't lead to explicit logical contradictions. Dr. Craig's arguments, in other words, don't demonstrate that a natural infinite is impossible, but only that a natural infinite leads to certain counterintuitive implications.
Okay, thank you. There's a question next door. These two. Okay. Go.
Right. Okay, this one is for Dr. Craig. You said that only two things can possibly exist before the universe. There's only two things that are timeless, spaceless, and so forth. That's
yes.
the abstract objects and
an unembodied mind.
Yeah, and the unembodied mind. Well, those are the only two things that we can think of from this universe that could have existed before it. But there could be a whole different range of things that could exist only outside of universes. Like, just to take an example, there could be several gods that are responsible for this rather than just one. So I think the monotheistic conclusion is just a little too specific, Nelly.
Okay. Abstract objects aren't something that exist in the universe. These would be things like mathematical objects and other sorts of things, but they don't stand in causal relations. You didn't really provide another alternative. What you said was maybe there are more than one unembodied mind, many gods, a plurality of gods. And I would simply say to that Occam's razor would shave away the multiplication of such causes. Occam's razor says you're only justified in positing such causes as are necessary to explain the effect. And one unembodied mind, one personal creator of the universe is sufficient. Occam's razor would shave away additional causes. And in addition to that, I think one could give other arguments for monotheism as well, but I think Occam's razor is sufficient to get rid of that plurality of gods.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Dr. King?
Yeah, I think Dr. Craig's assertion that the cause of the universe must be a personal being of some sort is based on a false dichotomy. He seems to presuppose that the universe can only have one of two kinds of cause, either a naturalistic cause or a personal cause. He wants to rule out naturalistic causes, and so he's left with a personal cause. Well, there might be other kinds of non-naturalistic explanations of the universe that aren't personal. I think at this very early stage in inquiry, we shouldn't rule out the possibility that there are non-personal, non-naturalistic explanations of the universe.
You're putting it a lot better than I did. Okay, thank you. So there was a gentleman in the black coat who's next, and then the lady behind who's next. Can you just put your hand up if you still want to ask questions? We'll try and get a map of. Okay. So if you stand, please.
Dr. Craig, your moral argument seems to be dependent on this idea of free will. However, there are many Christians who would deny such a thing. Calvinists, for instance, drawing from Romans chapter 6 through 9, would say that God does not merely allow evil, but is in some case the cause of evil. So why should we accept your philosophical presumption regarding free will as opposed to what would seem to be the revealed will of God?
Well, I would never say that you should believe my philosophical arguments over the revealed word of God in the scriptures. But I think that exegesis is quite mistaken. It seems to me that the presupposition of the New Testament is that we do have significant free will. Judaism thinks of human agents not as puppets or robots manipulated by God, but as free persons who are called upon to obey, love, and worship God, and they are morally responsible for those actions. And so I would disagree with those Christians who say that human beings do not have freedom of the will. I would say the same thing to them that I said to Daniel Kame. That reduces human beings to the status of moist robots. And they are not then moral agents who can be held responsible. In fact, as you almost suggested, it would make God the author of evil, which is abhorrent. God is the source of all goodness and cannot be the author of evil. So I would just resist that exegesis of the New Testament that some Christians would accept.
Okay. Dr. King?
Well, I think here again, Dr. Craig is assuming that there couldn't be a naturalistic account of human freedom. So it's just not the case that if we want to preserve human freedom in order to preserve morality, that we have to be theists. There are a wealth of accounts of human freedom that are naturalistic and that don't depend on the presupposition of God's existence.
Okay, thank you. There's this lady in the white jumper.
Hi, this is for Dr. Craig. One of your arguments is that the existence of evil also proves the existence of God. So what I'd like to ask is, if God is, you know, good, and he controls the universe, how can there be evil? So does that not kind of contradict that God exists? Like, if evil exists, God exists, but if God controls everything and he's good, there can't be evil. Or otherwise, that would mean that God is not just good, he's also evil. Does that make sense? Should I repeat?
Well,
I thought that was for you, Daniel.
It was for you. I think it was for you.
Oh. All right. Well, I found myself resonating with much of what you said as I understood it, that if God is good, then he will ultimately have morally sufficient reasons for the terrible evils that occur in this world and will hold human beings responsible for the evils that they freely perpetrate. I would just emphasize what I've said already a number of times, is that given the cognitive limitations that we experience, it's in principle impossible for us to say when some incidence of evil comes into our lives that we can say, yeah, in all probability, God doesn't have a good reason for allowing that to happen. We're just not in a position to say that. And I think Dr. Kame's argument, based upon the idea that there are four possibilities, seem to assume that the events in the world are randomly distributed. And as you said, that's not correct. They're providentially ordered by God. And it may well be that in order to providentially order a world of free creatures with significant moral freedom to his ultimate ends, that God may have to allow a good deal of evil and suffering, like the Holocaust, along the way.
So you referred to Dr. Craig's argument from evil for the existence of God. And I think that, I mean, if it were true that God is the only possible ontological foundation for objective moral values, then it would follow from the existence of evil that God exists. But as I've said, I reject that premise in Dr. Craig's moral argument. I don't think it's the case, I don't think it's clear, at any rate, that God is the only possible ontological foundation for objective moral values. I think if the moral argument were sound, that is, if God's existence really did follow from the existence of objective moral values and duties, then Dr. Craig would be justified in saying that the existence of evil itself entails the existence of God. But as I said, I don't think the argument's sound.
Okay, thank you. There were a bunch of questioners down here, so there's a question here.
This one's for Dr. Craig again. Earlier you made the argument that we cannot fully understand God's intelligence in some way and therefore be able to predict his objectives and his motives when he allows an evil act or a good act to occur. However, you also argue that via Occam's razor, right, we can shave it down to only one God, or that we can disallow other solutions. Aren't they contradictory views to be had?
Well, the first part was not quite accurate. It's not that we can't penetrate God's thoughts or his will. It's more that we have certain cognitive limitations on us, like our confinement in time and space, that makes it impossible for us to know what the future holds, or our lack of insight or intelligence. That's why these probability judgments are just beyond our ability. That was the first point. But your second point, yes, I said Occam's razor says don't multiply causes beyond necessity. You're only justified in positing those causes which are required to explain the effect in question. And so your question is what?
Well, if my question is flawed, then there is no question, but I'd like to see you on the left.
Well, maybe. So,
well, if I could respond to what Dr. Grace just said about the inscrutability of divine psychology, because I took it that that was an implication of his response to the problem of evil, that we can't reliably judge what God would do or what choices he would make, and that's at the root of Dr. Craig's response to the argument from evil. For all we know, the Holocaust was for the best because it sets in motion a causal chain that leads ultimately to some outweighing good. We can't fathom God's purposes, and that's why that's on Dr. Craig's view, why we can't make a reliable judgment as to what he would do. And I think another implication of that aspect of Dr. Craig's position is that in the final analysis, we can never say whether any event or occurrence is really good or evil. If we can't make judgments as to the ripple effects, the long-term consequences of any event or occurrence, then we can't say definitively of any event or occurrence that it's good or evil.
Okay, thank you. There was a second, that lady at the end.
My question is for Dr. Kame, and it's about the same, the problem of evil. I was wondering about the application of, I'm not sure, the C.S. Lewis's treatment of free will and the problem of pain, if you're familiar with it, and his argument that if there is to be free will in a universe, then some degree of human suffering is logically required. With regards to the ripple effects, would you find it as unconvincing to say that ultimately, if free will logically requires that God doesn't step in and quickly fix all evil by moral actors, that if God ultimately decides that us choosing to love him out of our own free will is more valuable than us being automatons, is that not still not a convincing argument for you that it is imaginable that God might decide that our free decision to love him is of enough value for that price to be paid? And just as a follow-on from that question, do you think the Christian belief as regards the incarnation of God and Jesus' suffering has any relevance to God's decision that some suffering is to be permitted?
Okay, well, I think the free will defense provides a fairly good response to the problem of moral evil, but it doesn't provide any kind of response to the problem of natural evil. I mean, most of the evil in the world is not caused by the misuse of human freedom. It's caused by natural processes and occurrences. So human freedom does nothing to account for the existence of natural evil.
Okay.
Let me say two things. First, natural evil forms part of the arena or theater in which free will decisions are made. And so they're not irrelevant. It may only be in a world which is attended by a great deal of natural evil that the maximum number of people would freely come to find God and his salvation. And I think it's not at all implausible that only in a world suffused with natural evil, as well as moral evil, that the optimal number of people would freely come to know God and his salvation. Now, to say again that God has a morally sufficient reason for permitting an event like the Holocaust is not to say that the Holocaust was good, as Daniel just implied. That's a consequentialist view of ethics, and I don't hold to that. The Holocaust was evil, but that is a different question from whether one has a morally sufficient reason to allow that evil to occur. And having such a reason doesn't mean that, therefore, the Holocaust was really good.
Thank you. As a question down the front, down here.
This is for Dr. Kame. Dr. Kame, Dr. Craig says that the universe had a beginning, and for him, the cause of it is God. Do you believe the universe had a beginning? And if so, what is the cause? And also, at the start of the debate, you said that you have in many ways looked for God. Where have you looked?
Well, I've looked at the arguments of natural theology. That's primarily where I've looked. And I found that none of them is convincing. As to your first question, how do I think the universe began? I don't know. I have absolutely no idea how the universe began. But I reject Dr. Craig's claim that the only plausible explanation for the existence of the universe is a supernatural being. I mean, cosmologists are busy trying to explain the origins of the universe in terms of the laws of physics. And they are optimistic that at least in principle, the universe could be explained in terms of the laws of physics. And as I've already said, I think Dr. Craig's inference to the existence of a supernatural being as the cause of the universe is based on a false dichotomy. It's not the case that the universe could only be caused by some naturalistic process or by some personal supernatural being. There might be some third option, which is some other non-naturalistic explanation.
Can I just say this before I finish?
No. Sorry, I just got to... No.
The charge of a false dichotomy is leveled against an argument that I haven't offered tonight. This is an argument by Professor Richard Swinburne that says there are two types of causal explanations. Explanations in terms of natural laws and initial conditions, and explanations in terms of personal agents and their volitions. And what Swinburne points out is that a first state of the universe cannot have an explanation in terms of natural laws and initial conditions because there is no prior physical state. But it can have an explanation in terms of a personal agent and his volitions. And this gives good reason, I think, to think that the cause of the universe is personal. But the argument I gave was that the only thing that fits the description of a timeless, causeless, necessary, immaterial thing is either an abstract object or a mind. And abstract objects aren't involved in causal relations, from which it follows that the cause of the universe is a personal mind.
Okay, thank you. There's a man in a light blue shirt. Yeah, if you stand, please, and he'll get you. Yeah, you.
I have a question there for Dr. Craig. He mentioned about the Holocaust or evils in general, how even though they are evils in the long run due to the consequences they cause, it might work out better in the long run from a moral or ethical point of view. Now, if God is omnipotent and he's such a great designer, couldn't he have designed the earth in such a way where evil didn't have to happen to create an ethically more sustainable result? Couldn't he have just created an ethically good world from the beginning?
Good, thank you.
Remember, it is the atheist here who has the burden of proof to show that God could have done such a thing. It's the atheist who claims that the evil and suffering in the world is improbable or impossible with respect to God's existence. My point is simply this, that according to the Bible, God's overriding purpose is not to get people to believe that he exists. He could obviously do that very easily by putting a neon cross in the sky. His overriding purpose is to draw people freely into a saving love relationship with himself. And we have no idea whether in a world in which God's existence was as plain as the nose on your face, or in which there were no evils and no suffering, that an optimal number of people would freely come to know him and love him and find salvation. In fact, I think that it's extremely plausible that only in a world that is, as I say, suffused with suffering and evil, that the optimal number of people would freely come to know God and find salvation. Now, is this some sort of airy-fairy speculation on my part? Not at all. If you read a modern missions handbook on where Christianity is growing at its most rapid rates around the world, it is precisely in countries that have experienced severe natural deprivations and moral evils. Countries like China, the Philippines, Ethiopia, Kenya, the Sudan, Ecuador, whereas in Western Europe and North America, the growth rates are basically flat because when people don't suffer, they don't need God. They don't turn to him. They're indulgent. So I don't think there's any way the atheist could prove that in a world without suffering, without evil, that people would freely come to God and find salvation in greater numbers than they do in our world filled with suffering.
Okay. Well, I think the fact that growth rates in Christian belief are as they are in areas of the world which are afflicted by great suffering is certainly consistent with the Christian hypothesis that God suffuses the world with great suffering in order to bring human beings into a personal relationship with him. But it's also, of course, consistent with a naturalistic hypothesis about the origins of religious belief, that it's as a result of profound emotional need in the face of a threatening and inhospitable world that people are led to religious belief. So I don't think the fact that rates of Christian belief are growing in those parts of the world does anything to support Christian hypothesis. It's consistent with the Christian hypothesis, but it doesn't support it.
Thank you. We've been going now for 2 hours and 10 minutes at full throttle, so I think it's time to bring the formal proceedings to a close. I'm going to stop because there is a further dimension to the night. But at the moment, what I'm going to do is I want to thank the two speakers for a really thoughtful, contentful, respectful, and stamina-filled exchange on tonight. So thanks very much.